Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government is here with county news, including some road and bridge construction updates. Lyme disease cases are climbing, and doctors say ticks are spreading far beyond their traditional range. We'll talk with a local doctor about the rise in tick-borne illnesses, the symptoms to watch for, and how to protect yourself and your family this summer. Independent pharmacies say they're losing money every time they fill some prescriptions, and some pharmacists in New York are pushing lawmakers to act before more local drugstores disappear. And the Women's Studio Workshop in Rosendale's new exhibit called Rock, Paper, Sister, exploring memory collecting and the meaning hidden in everyday life. All coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Justice Department from paying out any money from a new $1.8 billion fund. President Trump says this would go to anyone who claims they were targeted by the agency. Critics have said it's a slush fund that could pay money to rioters who assaulted police during the January 6th attack. Former U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi is set to testify in a closed-door hearing before members of Congress today. She's to answer questions about her handling of files belonging to late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Ava Berger reports.
The Republican-led House Oversight Committee is expected to question Bondi about how she handled the release of millions of documents. Critics have said the process was sloppy and revealed the personal information of some survivors. Bondi was ousted from the Justice Department's top job in April. Some Epstein survivors, like Danny Bensky, are frustrated that the hearing will be behind closed doors, not videotaped.
It should be transcribed, it should be filmed, and it should be publicly released as quickly as possible.
Bondi joins a growing list of high-profile people the committee has questioned about Epstein, including former President Bill Clinton and current Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Ava Berger, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as crude oil prices inch down. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials are up 180 points.
Speculators in futures markets are betting that oil will soon start flowing again through the Strait of Hormuz. But businesses that actually use oil say falling futures prices don't reflect the actual risk to supplies. ExxonMobil warned this week that physical stockpiles of oil are approaching record low levels. And unless they're replenished, oil prices could spike again in the coming weeks. AAA says retail gasoline prices in the U.S. dipped about 3 cents a gallon overnight, but the average price of $4.39 is still about $1.40 higher than before the U.S. launched its war with Iran. The U.S. trade deficit narrowed slightly last month. The Commerce Department says exports and imports both increased in April, but exports grew more. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
A rocket belonging to Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin company exploded during a test yesterday. NPR's William Jones reports.
The failed test on Thursday night at Cape Canaveral saw the night sky painted orange. Video footage shows the rocket on the pad, and then seconds later a large fireball erupts. Homes nearby were left shaking. Blue Origin said that the rocket, which is called New Glenn, exploded during an engine firing test. That test was being conducted ahead of a planned satellite launch next week. Posting on X, Jeff Bezos, who founded Blue Origin, said it's too early to know the cause. He said it's been a rough day, but the team would get back to rebuilding and flying. Nobody was hurt, and local officials say there's no threat from fumes. William Jones, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. Vice President Vance says a deal between the U.S. and Iran to stop the war is very close, but he says we're not there yet. He's also warning it's hard to say if or when President Trump would sign any deal. Iran has also demanded an end to Israel's attacks in Lebanon, and these are continuing. The U.S. Supreme Court has sided with a black death row inmate from Mississippi in a jury discrimination case. Will Stribling from Mississippi Public Broadcasting reports the inmate claimed racial bias.
Harry Pitchford was sentenced to death for his role in a 2004 Northern Mississippi grocery store robbery that ended with his friend killing the owner near Grenada. The jury that convicted Pitchford had one black juror and 11 white jurors. Pitchford's lawyers argued prosecutor Doug Evans improperly struck black prospective jurors from the jury pool. Courts have found Evans had a history of dismissing black jurors for discriminatory reasons. The Supreme Court, however, did not rule on whether prosecutors intentionally discriminated. Instead, the 5-4 ruling finds Mississippi's courts failed to properly handle Pitchford's jury discrimination challenge. The case now returns to the lower courts. For NPR News, I'm Will Stribling in Jackson, Mississippi.
Officials in southern Washington state say they've located the remains of 6 missing people from a chemical tank implosion this week. 2 people were already confirmed dead, bringing the death toll to 8 people. Authorities say 3 more people are unaccounted for at the paper mill site. They also warn the damaged tank is unstable and it's still leaking. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And thanks for you joining us, Mr. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He's Communications Director and joins us most Fridays. Happy Friday.
To you as well.
And there was no regularly scheduled meeting of the legislature yesterday.
No.
But that doesn't mean you don't have things to tell us.
Well, yeah, I guess. Well, of course I do. There's always something going on.
He's got a whole list, folks.
I do. I promise this will not be wasted time.
Well, so. Here, let's start with something that's on the top of people's minds as we head into this warmer season. A lot of road construction going on, seeing a lot of arrows on signs and orange cones and flaggers. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some bridges. The Neversink Crossing Bridge, that has been completed.
Yes. I always wanted to talk about the bridges of Sullivan County. Sorry, couldn't help myself. Anyway, I can hear the collective groan across the county. Yes.
Collective switching of stations.
No, please don't. We have a Swan Lake Bridge project that we're going to be doing, I think, later this year. But first, we have, because it's being funded with state Bridge New York funds, I think it's called, we have to have a public informational meeting on it, which is set for June 17th at 6 p.m. at the Liberty Senior Center. That's on North Main Street, right across from the town hall near the village hall. And this will be about a replacement of a bridge. Basically, it's what I would call Briscoe Road. It's county route. I can't remember the number, but it's intersects Route 55, State Route 55, right there in the heart of Swan Lake. It basically spans the outflow of the lake itself.
And then that Swan Lake Bridge replacement set, there's a public info meeting, I'm sorry, on the
right.
Swan Lake Bridge
mm-hmm.
replacement meeting for June
17th. June 17th, yep, 6 o'clock at the Liberty Senior Center. That's where you can come and hear all about what it is that is planned. You can ask questions. You can interact directly with the engineers of the project. It's nothing out of the ordinary. It's a bridge replacement, and it needs to be replaced for safety and maintenance reasons. But it is, of course, a fairly major artery in that part of the county. I certainly use it a lot myself, actually, even now. And people can have their awareness raised and their questions answered by attending the meeting.
While we're talking about bridges and construction, I want to remind folks of a couple of other traffic-related alerts. The Calicoon-Damascus Bridge, that major crossing across the Delaware River.
Another
in Calicoon.
Big one. Yes.
The next temporary closure of that bridge will be Tuesday, June 2nd, beginning at approximately 6 a.m., according to New York State Department of Transportation. This closure is needed for that ongoing construction activity, and it could last up to 48 hours. The rain date backup is June 3rd. Again, that is the Calicoon-Damascus Bridge, which spans the Delaware River between Calicoon and Sullivan County and Damascus Township in Pennsylvania. It's part of that $17.8 million rehabilitation project that includes the construction of new bridge spans. It was originally expected to continue through November 2027, but the latest update we heard was that it might even be completed by the end of this year. We'll still see. But again, the temporary closure of that bridge is scheduled for June 2nd at 6 a.m., and it could last up to 48 hours. Pedestrian and bicycle access is expected to remain open unless otherwise noted. And another construction delay coming up. This is in Route 209 from the city of Port Jervis boundary and Cuttybackville. That's according to the town of Deer Park Police Department. There should be, you should expect, if you're on that road, construction-related delays beginning early June as pavement repair work gets underway. They're going to mill and fill along 209 from that boundary of Port Jervis to the intersection with Route 211 in Cuttybackville. Work is expected to begin on or about June 1st and continue through November. Those are some latest traffic and construction updates. Not all of them, but some of the main ones we know of.
Oh, yeah, you'll run into more. Just please follow what the flagger's instructions are. Don't be speeding through. Don't be honking your horn. Be patient. These folks are not needing to put their lives on the line so that they can fix our roads and bridges.
And another thing that folks are noticing in Sullivan County are flaggers and construction folks working on that fiber installation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks still confused about all that orange tubing sticking up through the ground. Remind folks what's going on.
Yeah, it looks like alien earthworms. I saw that the other day. Every time, actually, I see it, I'm like, what? Oh, wait, yes, that's our project. So we've got fiber optic conduit that is being laid all over the county, it seems. In fact, where I saw it the other day was on the Briscoe Road that we just talked about. And it is being buried, so that's why you're seeing this conduit sticking up out of the ground. It's just as part of the process as they move forward. Trust me, it will all be stuck in the ground. I think there's only like 1% to 2% of the fiber optic that will be strung on poles. Because as I found out from our private partners, Archtop Fiber, it can take months for just one pole to get permission to put cabling on it. So this project never would have gotten done, I think, if that were the case. Think how many poles there are in Sullivan County. But it is supposed to be done by the end of this year, wiring over 22,000 homes and businesses with high-speed broadband internet. I know some people are like, well, don't we already have that? Some people may have that. This is now some competition, which is a good thing, but there are plenty of people that don't have that and either rely on satellite or on a cell signal. And instead, we can actually give them the top tier quality fiber optic cable, or if they're within range of one of our emergency communication towers, they will be able to get it wirelessly. It'll be similar to cell, but a different kind of setup called fixed wireless, meaning that it's not mobile. But that's really exciting, and it is in the works. Archtop is hooking up customers as we speak.
And this is a private-public partnership. The county's right. Not going to be your fiber optic provider. It's just this is part of a wider New York State program, the Connect All Municipal Infrastructure Grant Program, mm-hmm. to expand broadband throughout the entire state. And here in Sullivan County, the county's partnered with Archtop to do this installation.
Yes, that was our decision. We didn't have to partner with a private company, but they wanted to expand into the area. And we were like, we don't really want to be the one to do the provision of the actual internet service, the maintenance, the billing. They're going to handle all of that. What we did with the $30 million grant we got from the state is we purchased all the equipment, making it very economical for them to do it. They lease that equipment from us for the next 10 years, and then it becomes theirs. So then we're done, unless there's, of course, more expansion that we're involved in, which there could be, because this reaches between 60 and 70% of the county population. We want to get as close to 100% as possible. So there may be a phase two coming.
There's more information about all of that at connectsullivan.com. And while we're on the roads, a reminder that the Click It or Ticket seatbelt enforcement initiative is still in progress statewide.
Yes, this is not a county initiative. This is a state initiative, but I wanted people to know about it because most of us drive. That's just a necessity here in Sullivan County. Through the end of this month, the sheriff's office, but also the state police, are participating in this Click It or Ticket seatbelt enforcement initiative, where they're going to be looking specifically to see if you're wearing your seatbelt. You can get pulled over even if you're not speeding if you're not wearing your seatbelt. And that compliance is important. Seatbelts absolutely do save lives, and they keep you from becoming a menace to maybe the other people in your vehicle as well. Make sure everyone is belted in, front seat and back seat. I know it used to be like, oh, you could just seatbelt yourself on the front seat and the back seat's fine. No, you need everyone to be belted in, because otherwise you become flying missiles in car mm-hmm. accidents, and that can lead to lots of injuries, if not fatalities.
And note that in Pennsylvania, PennDOT and the Pennsylvania State Police have announced Operation Yellow Jacket, intended to speed enforcement in highway work zones. So they're going to be monitoring speeds, folks traveling in Pennsylvania through work zones. That is going to be another traffic and road-related thing to pay attention to in the region. Again, just drive safely.
Yes, please. It's a good idea.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll have more with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
Join the Kingfisher Project's Bill Williams for a powerful performance reflecting on the loss of his son due to opioid addiction and his family's journey through grief and healing.
If I help in some way to reduce the stigma around addiction, that makes me feel like I'm doing something in my son's honor, and that assuages, for want of a better word, the grief.
History of a Brief Time, tomorrow afternoon at 5 at the Lou Beach Community House, followed by an audience Q&A. Ticket information at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, joined in the studio live with Dan Hoost. Dan Hoost is here every Friday, most every Friday, to tell us what's going on at Sullivan County Government and countywide. Cool down locations have been posted. We finally get to talk about cool down versus heating and warming centers. Let's tell folks where those locations are.
Yeah, I got this information from our Health and Human Services folks on Friday, and I was like, oh, the way that weekend, the Memorial Day weekend was going to look, it's like, no. Does anyone want to talk about cooling off? We've had enough of that. But we're starting to get into the warmer season. We had some hot and humid days earlier this week. Mm-hmm. Trust me, they're returning. I know it doesn't feel like it at times. They're even talking about a dusting of snow up in the mountains of Vermont and New Hampshire this weekend.
But really?
Yes, they are.
Oh, my
but
gosh.
It is going to warm up. And the county does not have any official cooling centers. We're asked this every year. It takes a lot of money, effort, and manpower to mount these cooling centers, so it's not something that we've done. And in the past, our experience has shown that it's not necessary. People find ways to cool themselves off, but we want to be as helpful to folks as possible. So our Health and Human Services team, along with our HEAP team, actually our Home Energy Assistance Program folks, created a list of local cooling centers, mostly libraries in the area. The government center is one as well. And we tell people, you know, you can find places like Walmart or whatever. They're not going to kick you out for that. And if they do, let us know about it. But if it's a life-threatening emergency, don't hesitate to dial 911. We want to be there and help people. Just because we don't have an official cooling center doesn't mean that we're powerless to help if you have an issue where your air conditioner is conked out on you or you don't have one to begin with and it's getting really hot, especially during heat waves. We want to be that kind of county where neighbors care for each other.
Are there still any initiatives going on for folks to get some heat relief, you know, through any state or county programs?
Yeah, you can still apply for the cooling benefit through the HEAP program. That usually runs out of money pretty fast. So if you haven't applied by now, do it right away. And you can do so by getting in touch with our HEAP office. The information is at sullivanny.gov. I believe it's 807-0142, I believe is the number, if I recall correctly. They are eager to help you with that, but the money on that is limited to get you an air conditioner or a fan if you don't have a spot to put an air conditioner. But I know people who have gotten air conditioners at no cost, fully installed, professionally installed as well. You don't have to worry about, well, now I have an air conditioner, how am I going to heft it into a window? Nope. We'll take care of that for you through a contracted vendor. So it's a great program. And if you were looking for that kind of relief, go ahead and apply and see if you're eligible. Don't say, well, I'm probably not. Apply for it. See what happens.
As we mentioned at the top, there was no regularly scheduled legislature meeting yesterday. Mm-hmm. No update yet on sort of the sales tax deficit that we've been discussing, but County Treasurer Kathleen Lara in action at the annual finance school meeting from what group is this? NYSEC?
NYSEC. It's the New York State Association of Counties. This is probably one of their most prestigious offerings. Their finance school has been running for almost 60 years. annually, and it brings together financial administrators, treasurers, account clerks, all sorts of folks from around the state. We have 62 counties. Most of them, I think, were represented at this seminar up in, I think it was Albany or Saratoga. And she was a key speaker on a key topic, short-term rentals. And that's because she was part of the team under the prior county treasurer, Nancy Buck, but also in her tenure as a county treasurer, that has made sure that short-term rentals are paying room tax and sales tax appropriately, because they need to be on the same footing as what we do with hotels and motels and resorts in the area. We were, I think, the first county in the state and probably one of the first in the nation to start assessing room tax in an agreement that we had with Airbnb. So we are considered a statewide, if not national, expert on how to do this the right way. And kudos to Kathleen and her team for being part of that and educating the next generation of financial folks who are leading our municipalities across the state.
So she was invited to speak about that at this
conference. Oh, yes.
In Albany. Also, I want to remind folks, the Citizens Preparedness Training coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Monday, June 8th. Let's remind folks what that is and why it's so important.
I tell people it's a place to get free stuff and have fun. It is. They give you a goodie bag of all sorts of handy emergency preparedness items for free. The whole training is for free. It's done typically in association with our Office of Public Safety, the state Department of Homeland Security Emergency Services, and the New York State National Guard. Usually they're the ones sending an instructor. It's going to be happening at the Tustin Town Hall in Narrowsburg on June 8th at 2 p.m. If that's not convenient for you, don't worry. There are more coming. I'll have another one to talk about, I think, that's set for either later June or July, because these have proven to be very popular. We just need to be prepared for emergencies. This is about how you personally, in your own home and business, can be prepared for fires, floods. They'll probably even talk about earthquakes and hurricanes. As rare as they are, they can happen in the area. And then, like I said, you'll come away with items that can help you stay prepared for that. It is popular for a reason. People find this extremely valuable. It's worth your time, and it won't cost you anything.
And you get tools to prepare for emergencies and disasters, mm-hmm. as also, you know, how to respond accordingly, yes. if these things happen, and recover. So these are, you know, before, during, and after.
And to be that person in your community who doesn't panic, but handles things as they need to be handled when these disasters inevitably occur, because they will.
And we're seeing more and more of them. Mm-hmm. Let's give folks an election update. The primary in New York is coming up June 23rd. Mm-hmm. The sample ballots are up on the website.
They are.
And you're looking for, at the county level, some election poll inspectors?
Yeah, that's what they're called. People would consider them poll workers, but they're election inspectors, yeah. is the official title
Sounds
of it.
Sounds more efficient, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, doesn't it?
Need a badge?
You get paid. You get paid to do it. So and you not only get paid to actually serve, but you get paid to be trained as an election inspector. I think it's around $40 or so that you get for the training, and then $300 for serving as an election inspector. And I think that can increase, too, if you do it more than just on primary day, which is June 23rd. The almost 2 weeks prior to that, most of those days, we're going to have early voting as well at the government center in Monticello and at the public health building in Liberty. We're going to need election inspectors there. And honestly, this sounds like a cliche, but the more the merrier. You're never alone at these poll sites. You're always with somebody else. And people really actually have a great time together with other election inspectors, especially since this kind of a job attracts people. Sorry, I had to say that. But these are the people who actually make sure that the voters understand what it is that they need to understand in the mechanics and process of voting. If there's a concern or an issue over that, they're the front line with that. Our Board of Elections loves having them, as many people as possible, to sign up for this. 807-0400. That's 807-0400. Trust me, you will make their day at the Board of Elections if you call up and say, I'd like to do this.
And a reminder again, the primary in New York is June 23rd. The deadline to register to vote in the primary is June 13th. Applications must be received by the Board of Elections by that date. In this closed primary system in New York, the ballots are going to vary depending on where you are. That means you're limited to participate to registered party members.
Republicans and Democrats only. Yep.
And there are a couple of things coming up. Democrats voting for a statewide primary for state comptroller. While Republicans will vote in primaries for Congress in the 19th and state Senate 51st. So those are it's an important primary, an important election year. Again, check with the Board of Elections for your status or more information.
We want to make sure everyone who wants to vote gets a chance to vote as long as they're eligible.
The Veterans Service Agency is closing next week, but that's just so that staff can do some training.
Yes, it's only temporary. I had been using the word briefly, but since it's a whole week, my boss said, is that really briefly? I said, boy, the older I get, the more a week does feel brief. But anyway, it's just temporary. The first week of June, they have to do some mandatory training, I think, with the Veterans Administration, even though we are not the Veterans Administration. That's in an office building near the government center. We are the Veterans Service Agency. This is something that legislators years and years and years ago were like, we need to be there for our veterans as well, not just the federal government. It's not something we're mandated to provide, but it's wonderful that we have this office staffed by actual veterans. So they will be available before that and after that. So, well, basically today, and then you'll have to wait till the second week of June because no appointments or walk-ins will be accepted during that week because they have to get this training done. And listen, we want them to be as well educated as possible on the latest information.
Just temporary. And I want to thank our vets, of course, and thank the communities, which held some Memorial Day service celebrations this past Monday.
It was wonderful. I had a chance to be at two. I always go to Grahamsville's, which is not a county event. I just go because it's a very unique flag exchange event. But then I had the honor of live streaming the Memorial Day service at our Veteran Cemetery in Liberty, which is always full of meaning and a somber moment, but also one where you're gathering with people. It just feels right. It feels good to do that.
Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, have a great weekend. Any big weekend plans? Are you going skiing in Vermont this weekend?
No, I am not going skiing in Vermont. I might go back over, though, to where we put in the new Neversink Crossing Bridge. I took a film of it yesterday. It was it's going to connect our O&W rail trails between Woodridge and South Fallsburg. The bridge is in place. The first time a bridge has been on those piers in over 70 years. So I'm sorry, I'm a railroad nut, so I'm going to have to go there this weekend. And just, I can't walk across it yet, but I can stare at it and go, oh, anticipation.
If you see a strange man on the side of the bridge. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, from Lyme disease to the growing concern over alpha-gal syndrome, we're talking tick safety with a local doctor, tips on preventing bites, and what to do if you find a tick. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, comedian and actor Jeff Hiller. Hiller won a 2025 Emmy for his role on the television series Somebody Somewhere. His memoir is called Actress of a Certain Age, My 20-Year Trail to Overnight Success. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
This week on Science Friday, Pope Leo released his encyclical on AI. Can the Holy Father and his science advisors help us make sense of it?
We live in a moment of two tensions, a kind of a techno-effervescence and techno-panic.
Plus, using weather radar to count the insects above our heads. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Cases of Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses are rising sharply across the country, according to the latest CDC data. Health experts say warmer weather and expanding tick habitats may be helping drive the increase. I spoke with Dr. Kavita Agarwal of Optum Medical Care to discuss symptoms, prevention, and what you should know heading into this potentially bad summer season for tick-borne illnesses.
It's really quite incredible if you look at the data. So what's interesting is that cases of tick-borne illness in Lyme specifically has exploded over the last 4 years. If you look at the data that's on the CDC website, you'll see that in 2021, there are about 20,000 cases over the expanse of America. And then in 2023, almost 90,000 cases. So it's really quite astounding. And we think what's happening is that, you know, due to climate change, we have warmer weather. The ticks are not dying. They are living year-round. And they're actually expanding where they're living. So it's not just a disease or an issue of the Northeast, but it's expanding westward, including the Midwest and beyond. So that's what we think is going on. And it's good that we're having this talk today so we can educate our listeners on what to do to prevent, right?
Yeah, and we want to talk about some of those prevention measures, but also want to ask about some of these other illnesses we're hearing about beyond Lyme disease, some of which I can't pronounce. What are some of these?
Let's go through them.
Why are those becoming more common?
So, you know, the first thing to understand is that there are many different kinds of ticks, okay? And the two ticks that typically give us Lyme disease are the black-legged tick and the western black-legged tick. But in addition to multiple ticks, there are multiple infections that these ticks can transmit. So obviously we know about Lyme disease, but there's also ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. Now, the three of these present typically very similar symptoms, fevers, chills, malaise, headache, nausea, arthralgias, myalgias, which is aches and pains of the muscles and joints. The difference between ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis compared to Lyme is that the blood work would be a little different, so that's where blood testing can help to differentiate, but treatment is similar. There's also babesiosis, which is actually a parasite that behaves very similar to malaria, and those symptoms can include profound anemia, malaise, and that one is a little bit more serious, can sometimes lead to hospitalization, and requires treatment with multiple different antibiotics. But again, you know, if you have a tick-borne illness, whatever, you see your doctor, you get checked out. A couple years ago, there was also Powassan virus, which we're not seeing as much anymore. More in the West Coast, there's Rocky Mountain spotted fever. There's tularemia. And what the Department of Health is now notifying us about, which is new, is alpha-gal syndrome. Is that the one that you were thinking about?
Yeah.
In your research?
What is that?
Yeah. So what's interesting is that there is a protein called alpha-gal that is present in meat. And people who are allergic to this can develop allergic symptoms when they eat meat. Now, when a tick has the same alpha-gal protein in them, and we're thinking if they have it in them because they have bitten a host who has it, and then they have it, and then they can pass it on to the next person that they, you know, take a blood meal with and bite, and then pass it on from person to person. So if a person is exposed to this protein introduced by a tick bite, and they are sensitive to it, then they can get an allergic reaction response as well. So it presents not like Lyme would, but more like an allergic reaction, hives, swelling, shortness of breath, like an anaphylactic episode, which can be quite serious. So, you know, if anything like that happens, talk to your doctor, go to the ED.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions people still have about ticks and Lyme disease?
I feel like our, you know, average person is really quite well-versed, especially here in the Northeast, about being wary about it in the summer months. I guess a misconception could be that thinking that it is only an infection of the summer. Now we're trying to educate our patients that it's present all year round. We've had mild winters, although this past winter wasn't that mild. But, you know, lately we've had mild winters. And if you're out and about and you're in areas where there could be a tick and they're living, you could still, you know, get a bite and get tick-borne illness. So I guess that would be one misconception that we're trying to educate our patients on.
Let's talk about more education. Some common symptoms people should watch for after a tick bite. Many people know about the classic bullseye rash associated with Lyme disease, but does everybody get that symptom?
No. So, you know, just to backtrack a little bit, only one third of tick bites are actually even noted. So two thirds of tick bites go unnoticed. They're so tiny, they don't really hurt. It's only if you happen to see it on your body that you're going to notice they have a tick bite. And then as far as symptoms usually for Lyme especially typically begin about 2 weeks after the bite. And the first presentation can be, and it doesn't have to be, can be that target lesion, the bullseye. And that's not present all the time, only in a fraction of the cases. Honestly, it's kind of nice if that does happen, because then you can see it and then act on it and get treatment. But like I said, most of the time, you're not aware of the tick bite. You don't get a rash, and then it can develop into the next stages of Lyme. And that's when you want to watch out for those other symptoms I mentioned. So for Lyme specifically, very nonspecific, very flu-like symptoms, fevers, chills, headache, malaise, tired, achy, that kind of thing, which in the winter you might think is a viral illness, but in the summer, if you're having that, the first thing to think about is Lyme, see your doctor, get checked out.
If you do notice the tick, how quickly should you remove it, and what's the safest way to do it?
A very good question, Tim. So you want to remove it as soon as you see it, okay? What you want to use is a clean tweezer, a sharp tweezer ideally, but if it's a blunt tweezer, that's fine. You want to make your skin taut. You want to place the tweezer as close to your skin and as close to the probe from the tick that's in your body, in your skin, and extract the tick from there as opposed to from the body, because if you put pressure on the body, the poker, the stinger may still remain in the skin. You want to sort of take it out as an angle. Don't try to pull and tug too much. And if you can't get all of the remnants out, it's okay. Eventually it'll come out, you know, the rest of it if the stinger is left in. You want to then clean the skin with like a rubbing alcohol swab. And then since you saw that one tick, don't assume that's it. Do a full skin body check and make sure there's no other ticks on you.
Children and older adults appear to be among the groups most affected by tick-related ER visits, that spike we were talking about earlier. Why are those populations especially vulnerable?
I think, you know, because they may not have the capacity to act on it. Children certainly are nonverbal, right? And they may not know what's going on. So you really do need to depend on your parent to watch for symptoms. And if you have children, they're at camp, they're in the playground, especially the summer months, and maybe even year-round, where they're out and, you know, doing risky things in the park or in the, you know, gardens and fields and whatnot, make it a habit to do a tick check when they come inside, and then you do a full body check. That way you can make sure that doesn't happen. And I think in the elderly, right, they're just not as aware. Maybe they're focused on their other health issues. Maybe they're not as cognizant. And those are populations are more vulnerable in general.
And for folks who are outdoors, you know, gardening, camping, hiking, what are some of the most effective prevention steps? And how effective are insect repellents like DEET or treated clothing?
Yes, so let's talk about that because, again, you know, the prevalence is increasing. So our first thing that we can do, number one thing that we should do is prevention. You can actually spray your clothing and gear before you go out on a hike. And what we recommend typically is 0.5% permethrin. As far as bug spray with DEET, that is something that you would apply on the exposed body parts, right? It's definitely effective. The data shows that it protects, but you want to be cautious in children under the age of 3. If you have a child of that age, speak to your pediatrician just to see, you know, what they would recommend that would be safe. But honestly, you also, you know, can wear long sleeve clothing, full sleeve shirt, long pants, tuck them in your socks. That way the tick doesn't have any opportunity to get onto your skin. And then just going back to, like, what else can you spray in your body? In addition to the bug spray with DEET, there's also picaridin, IR3535, eucalyptus oil, PMD, and another medication, very hard to pronounce, 2-undecanone. But again, with caution, children under 3, talk to your pediatrician.
Lots of unpronounceable things when it comes to ticks and Lyme disease. Yeah. But what should pet owners keep in mind during tick season?
Yes, very important because, you know, often it's the pets that bring it in.
Yeah.
So pets are outdoors, they're rolling around in your lawn, they come back. So I believe there are products that you can spray your backyard with. There's also preventative products that your pet can use. Talk to your vet about that. And often we recommend that before you allow your dog or pet, you know, back in the house, you can do a tick check on them and outside, obviously, not inside, use rollers and whatnot to sort of, you know, do a thorough check, before, allowing the pet back in. And then, you know, again, just be careful because nothing's going to be foolproof in that setting. And then maybe just do tick checks yourself, you know, each night if you do have a pet, just to make sure nothing has wandered into your environment.
And finally, what's your top advice for folks heading outdoors this summer who want to stay safe but still enjoy the season, still enjoy the sun?
Yes, and I want to emphasize this. Please enjoy the beautiful Hudson Valley. It's gorgeous. We should enjoy it. We should not be limited. But well, if we be safe, then we'll be fine. So we talked about, you know, spraying your clothes. We talked about using bug spray with DEET and these other products. The other thing is when you're, you know, in a high-risk environment on a hike or a trail, walk in the center of the trail. Try to avoid the edges. That's where those brushes and tall grasses and trees will be, because those ticks are at the edge waiting for a passerby to come by to jump onto. So if you walk the center of the trail, that would be ideal. We talked about what kind of clothing to wear, right? Long sleeves, long pants, tuck them in the socks. And then when you come back home, then it is ideal to toss the clothes in the dryer on hot temperature, high heat, 10 minutes, and then take a shower. And what that allows us is to wash off any ticks that have not bitten yet but are just on you. And it also gives you an opportunity to do a full, you know, body skin check. You also want to pay attention to the areas that they like to go to. And those are the warm, moist areas, like under your arms, by your ears, belly button, the hairline, your legs, your waist, and behind your knees. If you do that, then, you know, we can do the best we can to prevent tick bite and then tick-borne infection and still enjoy beautiful Hudson Valley.
That's Dr. Kavita Agarwal at Optum Medical Care. Thank you so much for the advice.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come, why some independent drugstores say they're being forced to fill prescriptions at a loss and what lawmakers could do about it. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
This week on Cat's Cast, no one has ever seen an American eel spawn. No one knows what draws them to the Hudson River or to Black Creek, but every spring they come. And a team of students and volunteers is there to count them.
That is a beautiful mystery. And then, like, what drives them to follow the Gulf Stream or use the Gulf Stream, you know, for momentum? What makes them choose the Hudson River?
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. Some independent pharmacies across the region say they're being squeezed by powerful middlemen in the prescription drug industry, and some are closing their doors as a result. Now, lawmakers in Albany are considering legislation supporters say could help level the playing field. The New York Public News Network's Sam Dingman reports.
Jared Nikos and his family have been in the pharmacy business since the 1950s. As he and his uncles like to say,
it's a lifestyle. It really is. It's a very difficult, rewarding, of course, but it's a very difficult task.
Jared's talking specifically about the lifestyle of running an independent pharmacy. His family owns five of them, including Nikos Dedrick's Pharmacy in Kingston. That's the location Jared's been running since earlier this year, when his uncle decided he didn't want to do it anymore.
My uncle was looking for a new role because of the, you know, pressures that are being applied, outside pressures.
The pressures Jared's talking about have to do with PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers. Those are the companies that handle prescriptions for health insurance companies. Three of them, Caremark, Optum, and Express Scripts, manage between 80 and 90% of all prescriptions in the United States. Caremark is owned by CVS, which also owns Aetna Healthcare. Optum is a subsidiary of United Healthcare, and Express Scripts is owned by another health insurance company, Cigna. That gives those three PBMs extraordinary control over the pricing and distribution of prescription medications. And for years now, independent pharmacies have been complaining that those three companies are reimbursing them at below market rates. Kelly McMahon is the executive director of the Pharmacists Society of the State of New York. I spoke to her Wednesday at a rally about prescription pricing at the state capitol. She told me pharmacies that aren't affiliated with the so-called big three just can't compete.
For example, if it costs them $100 to purchase a prescription, they're being reimbursed $80. So they're losing money to fill that prescription, and pharmacies are closing at an alarming rate. So
case in point, says Jared Nikos, lisinopril, a blood pressure medication.
You have something like lisinopril where you might make 20 cents on it, and that doesn't even cover the cost of the vial, the label, and then you throw in labor overhead, you know, it leaves the store at a $7 or $8 loss by the time and you incorporate all the other expenses associated with dispensing that medication.
As Kelly mentioned, pharmacies around the country have been going out of business. A recent study in Health Affairs, a policy research journal, found that nearly 30% of the pharmacies that opened between 2010 and 2020 had closed. During the three-year period between 2018 and 2021, more pharmacies closed than opened. And it's not just small, independent pharmacies shutting down. Rite Aid, which was a major chain, but did not have that vertical integration with a PBM, closed all of its stores last year. One of them was just down the road from Jared Nikos' pharmacy in Kingston. On the one hand, he told me, that was great. New customers are always welcome. But on the other hand, a lot of those customers needed prescriptions that are managed by the PBMs.
Now we're, you know, losing big money on a lot of their scripts. It's a very interesting business.
For now, Jared and his family's pharmacies have been able to stay afloat by competing at the service level. Nico's stores, he says, are the kind of place where your pharmacist knows your name.
People seek us out specifically because they're looking for a higher level of care. People really need to feel like a human being, not just a number, not just a serialized transaction where pushing them out the door to get the next person in.
He also thinks indie pharmacies have another advantage, accessibility.
You can literally just walk in and talk to us and get, you know, a consultation, recommendations, immunization, all within, you know, 5 to 10 minutes and no appointment necessary in most places and times.
Jared is a supporter of the bill that Kelly McMahon was at the Capitol to rally for yesterday, the Patient Access to Pharmacy Act, or PAPA, as its supporters call it. If passed, it would guarantee a minimum reimbursement level for pharmacies around the state.
So this bill asks for the Medicaid rate. No other company or organization is coming in asking for the Medicaid rate because it's so low, but that'll be a step up for these pharmacists. And so we're asking.
The PAPA bill has passed through the state Senate. It's currently being debated in the Assembly. This is actually the second year it's passed through the Senate, and Jared is hoping this is the year it finally becomes law.
You know, the industry in general really needs some. Really needs a little bit of a transformation in order to make sure that we have plenty of longevity and we're not going to be replaced by, you know, a few gargantuan dispensers.
New York's legislative session ends June 4th. I reached out to Caremark, Optum, and Express Scripts for comments on this story. In an emailed statement, a spokesman from the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, a trade organization representing PBMs, disputed the claim that PBMs are underpaying pharmacies. He criticized the Patient Access to Pharmacy Act, writing, quote, "Rushing through legislation in the final days of the legislative session could have serious unintended consequences, primarily higher drug prices." A spokesperson from Caremark also emailed, saying, quote, "CVS Caremark relies on the New York independent pharmacies in our networks to ensure access for consumers. On average, we reimburse New York independent pharmacies more than we do our own CVS pharmacies in the state." For the New York Public News Network, I'm Sam Dingman.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. An upcoming exhibit at the Women's Studio Workshop in Rosendale is taking a closer look at the meaning we attach to everyday objects and routines. Rock Paper Sister is opening June 5th. Exploring the themes of memory, accumulation, and the significance of ordinary life through prints, paper, and mixed media. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Faith Levine of the Women's Studio Workshop for more.
The Women's Studio Workshop in Rosendale presents Rock, Paper, Sister, an exhibit noting the everyday that is often overlooked. Kate Bingaman Burt and Elizabeth Salka's work will be on view from June 5th through September 18th. And we have Faith Levine here today to tell us all about it and give us a little background on the Women's Studio Workshop. She is Specific Collections and Public Engagement Manager, and she is also curator of this particular exhibit. So welcome, Faith.
Hi, Valerie. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, let's start with a brief history of the Women's Studio Workshop.
Absolutely. So Women's Studio Workshop was actually founded in 1974 in Rosendale, New York. So we're just outside of Kingston. And we were founded by four women who really wanted to make a space for women to be able to create and promote their artwork. And in 2017, we were able to broaden our mission. So we serve women, trans, intersex, non-binary, and gender fluid artists at this time. And we do that in lots of different ways.
And can you tell us a little bit about your involvement there? How long have you been involved?
Absolutely. So my current position as Special Collections and Public Engagement Manager came out of an initial 2.5-year grant through the Hauser and Wirth Institute, where I became the archivist, the first full-time archivist in our organization's 50-year history, working with our collection and our artist books and making sure that our collection is available to the public and we can answer research questions and serve our artists in residence by supporting them with questions they might have about the work that's in our collection. So since that funding ended in December of 2025, my job expanded into managing the collection and also doing programming like our exhibitions and our gallery space, doing artist book sales, and lots of other arts nonprofits, odds and ends.
Tell us a little bit about the artist books.
Absolutely. So Women's Studio Workshop has been publishing artist books since 1979. We have an incredible history of people who have been through our program. We support artists in the production of making their books on site on our campus. We have an artist residency grant where artists submit a proposal, and if they're accepted through that process, they come, they live on our campus, they print the book on site. We have a number of different studios that people can work in making their books with the support of our incredible studio staff and interns. And then we represent them in the sales of those books. And we have a number of institutions and repositories around the country that we work directly with. And we do artist book fairs around the country as well.
And I see you also have classes for young folks as well.
That's right. So we have classes for, we actually serve the public with classes. And one of the ways we do that is we have a 40-year-long relationship with the Kingston County School District with a program called Art in Education, where elementary school and high school students come to our campus in the fall and spring and work directly with professional artists to gain experience and better understand art-making practices. And then they also have an exhibition with the work that they make in our studios. It's really fantastic. So we just celebrated the 40th anniversary of that relationship. And then in the summer, we have Summer Arts Institute classes, which are open to the public. So anyone can come and take those classes. It's fantastic. We've been doing that program for over 40 years as well. And all of that information is available on our website.
And the website is?
Our website is wsworkshop.org.
Well, thank you for all of that interesting information on your wonderful history. Let's move on now to the exhibit, Rock, Paper, Sister. This has such a unique theme. I found it a lot of fun.
Yeah, so Rock, Paper, Sister is a joint exhibition with two artists. It opens on June 5th, as you mentioned, and runs actually all through the summer until September 18th. So it's up for quite a long time. Kate Bingham Burt is an artist who's based in Portland, Oregon, and Elizabeth Salka is an artist who's actually based here in the Hudson Valley. So she'll be present at the opening on June 5th.
And tell us a little bit about their work and about what the theme
Absolutely.
Is.
Yeah, so Kate and Elizabeth are two artists who work around themes of consumerism, memory, accumulation, and they're both really playful. So Kate's work, I first became familiar with Kate's work actually back in 2007. We've worked together for over 20 years in numerous capacities, and Kate does these incredible illustrations, hand-drawn illustrations, around things that she buys every day. She had a long-running project that some people might be familiar with called Obsessive Consumption. She used to draw her monthly credit card statements to think about what she was purchasing, think about debt, consumerism, and transparency. And then she would take all of those illustrations and compile them into these little zines, those booklets, and share those out as a part of her art practice. And so she's now a designer at Portland State University and runs the department there. And then Elizabeth is an artist who I actually became familiar with fairly recently and first saw her work in Catskill at a pop-up earlier this year. And Elizabeth goes by the Instagram handle Betty Rubble. And she is working with basically rocks, to kind of put it in a simple way. Elizabeth is collecting rocks and brick and rubble from the street and around kind of where she's walking. And then she's taking those rocks and she's painting them. And I know that might sound simple, but if you look at her work, it's pretty extraordinary. She's taking the rocks and she's transforming them into objects that you might find in your pantry or in your kitchen drawer. And she's transforming them into these hyper-realistic, but you can kind of like really see the hand element of her painting within this work. But they're really playful and they're also rooted a lot within her memory of different things that she purchased, you know, or would see when she was a kid or a teenager. And so both of these artists are looking at consumerism through this playful lens.
Yes, they are playful. And I also have to agree with you that they do not look simple. These are not just smooth rocks with a drawing.
What I'm fascinated with is how she's able to look at a rock and then kind of connect it to the shape of something enough to then transform it into that object. And sometimes I have a piece of hers. It looks like a realistic kind of alarm clock that I would have had in junior high in the 90s, like those digital brown alarm clocks with the red LED screens. And it looks like, at a first glance, it looks like the actual alarm clock, but it's a little bit warped. You know, the perspective is a little bit off. So if you look at it closely, you can just see the exquisite attention to detail that she's able to do with these pieces of her artwork. And it's really phenomenal. And she also has these really incredible titles for all of her work that are really humorous and playful. It was actually her idea to call the exhibition Rock Paper Sister. I do want to give her that credit. We got a really kind of incredible way of connecting words with her work and memory. And so she does a lot of long form writing on her Instagram posts that are also a really interesting way to look at the work that she's creating.
You can get a link to both of the artists' website if you go to wsworkshop.org. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think, you know, I would like to say that if folks want to join us on June 5th at Women's Studio Workshop from 6 till 8 p.m. and come celebrate the opening of the exhibition, they're absolutely welcome. Otherwise, the gallery is open Monday through Friday from 9 to 5 or by appointment. If you've always been interested about Women's Studio Workshop and you've never come by, you know, we love giving tours. We want to share the work that we're doing with our community. And we've been doing that work since 1974. So, you know, give us a shout out, and we hope to see some new faces.
Okay, well, have fun at your exhibit.
Thank you so much, Valerie. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that report. And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We hope to see you tomorrow at the Lou Beach Community House for the Kingfisher Project's Bill Williams and a powerful performance reflecting on the loss of his son to opioid addiction and his family's journey through grief, struggle, and healing. It's History of a Brief Time tomorrow at 5 at the Lou Beach Community House. Tickets are $20 at the door, and all proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. It's a powerful performance with an audience Q&A to follow. I'm Tim Bruno. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
CBS News Radio is no more, and while obits for the network celebrate nearly a century of broadcasting, back in 1928, the launch was less than promising.
CBS is this upstart company formed by a stock promoter and a talent agent. The early reviews of the first performances don't make you want to tune in again.
The hidden history behind CBS's success on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Partly sunny today, breezy with a high of 69. Still breezy tonight, maybe a couple of showers possible, a low of 46. We'll see more sun this weekend compared to last weekend with low humidity and dry much of the time. Tomorrow it will be cooler and a little windy, high 60. Sunshine and clouds on Sunday and 68. On Point is next.